This is the last day of this October 2015 7-day session. And we'll take up a koan today. This is from the collection known as the Blue Cliff Record, sometimes the Blue Rock Record. Number 89, The Hands and Eyes of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion. Ungan asked Dogo, "What use does the great Bodhisattva of Compassion make of all those hands and eyes?" Dogo said, "It is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night." Ungan said, "I understand." Dogo said, "How do you understand it?" Ungan said, "The whole body is hands and eyes." Dogo said, "You've had your say, but you have only said 80% of it." Ungan said, "How would you put it?" Dogo said, "The outside is hands, the inside is eyes." So just a little bit about these two masters who went on to become masters. I'm going to stick with the Japanized names. The Ungan, that's the Japanized name. His Chinese name was Yunyan, just for the record. And Dogo's Chinese name, his real name, was Dao Wu. But I think it's just easier to relate to these characters, a little easier with the Japanese rather than the Chinese pronunciations. They were brother monks who had the same teacher, Yanshan. One source said that they were biological brothers. Dogo, 7 years older than Ungan. They lived in the 9th century, the Tang Dynasty. And again, they went on to become very well-known Zen masters in China. And that's all I'm going to say about them as far as their biographical material. We have too much other material about the third person in this koan, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. I'm going to turn to this excellent source of Bodhisattva lore that we read from the first day of Sesshin, Faces of Compassion, Classic Bodhisattva Archetypes and Their Modern Expression. And I think the other kind of subtitle is more descriptive of this book and what why I would commend it so much is An Introduction to Mahayana Buddhism. So the author Taigen Dan Layton outlines the book in the basis of major Mahayana bodhisattvas, but really the book is a great source of material on Mahayana Buddhism. And one of the chapters in this, one of the major bodhisattvas, and really the longest chapter, is Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is the original Indian name of the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And then when she went to China, she became Guanyin, or Kuanyin with a K sometimes. And then when she got to Japan, Kanon, Kanzeon. I'll be just skipping through and picking up some points here about this most famous bodhisattva. The author says the Sanskrit name can be translated as Gazing Lord, or Lord of what is seen. Another interpretation, more common in East Asia, could be translated as Regarder of the Cries of the World and Perceiver of Sounds. These are the meanings represented by Chinese and Japanese names, Guanyin, Kanzeon, Kanon. So the emphasis is on sounds, hearing the cries of the world. Quickly, he outlines seven forms of the bodhisattva of compassion. The first is sacred or honorable Avalokitesvara. And this one is more elegant and simple than other manifestations, with just a single face and two hands, holding a lotus or a vase in one hand, while the other hand is held out in the mudra or hand gesture for allaying fear or for offering. He says that the earliest conceptions of Avalokiteshvara date back to the 3rd century BC. You can see that's some 2,200, 2,300 years that this bodhisattva has occupied importance in world religion, mainly Buddhism. And you have to take from that that it's an exceedingly basic need that we have as human beings to understand and to worship, by some people, this archetype of compassion and how it resonates with us as human beings. The second form of Avalokiteshvara is 11-faced Avalokiteshvara. In sculptures, the 11 faces are shown set like a crown of smaller heads above the figure's main head. We have at least one of these figures at Arnold Park. Yeah, he says the preeminent story about the 11-faced Avalokiteshvara describes how the bodhisattva saved all the many suffering beings from out of the samsaric realms of birth and death. As she was carrying them into the pure land of liberation, she looked back and beheld all the spaces in samsara being filled again by new beings, and her head split apart in grief. After this happened 10 times, Amitabha provided a new head. The relationship between Avalokiteshvara and Amitabha. Amitabha is one of the Buddhas more prominent in other sects of Buddhism than Zen. A non-historical Buddha. Avalokiteshvara is considered an emanation of Amitabha. So then Amitabha provided her with a new head, and with the aid of a final Buddha's head, Avalokiteshvara was able to continue and sustain her liberative work. The third form is thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. Now we're getting closer to the the koan. It's the most renowned and metaphorically pregnant representation of the Bodhisattva of compassion. This figure's thousand arms are sometimes depicted symbolically with 20 arms on each side, each of the 40 representing arms functioning in 25 realms. But many paintings and statues actually include 1,000 arms flowing like a fan out on either side of the torso. In addition to the hands outstretched at its sides, one pair of hands usually is joined palm to palm at chest height. Remember that one? Palm to palm. In the gesture of respect. Another pair of hands is often held together low at the abdomen, palms facing upward in the meditation mudra, or sometimes holding a medicine or begging bowl. In Japan, one can still see large, magnificent examples of such statues, some seated, some standing. Each of these thousand hands has an eye in its palm. This portrayal of the one pair of hands held low at the hara, palms up in the meditation position, has a lot of significance we'll get to a little later. This to finish up the other representations of the Bodhisattva of compassion. There's the horse-headed Avalokiteshvara. In this manifestation, she expresses compassion with an angry, terrifying visage for whoever needs such incitement to awaken or be helped. It's an instructive representation, because compassion doesn't just have to be sweet and nice. Sometimes harshness is the most compassionate response to someone. The fifth form of Avalokiteshvara is turning the wish-fulfilling gem. And this is very interesting to me. He says, part of the compassionate work of a bodhisattva is simply to give beings what they want. The frustration of basic material needs often blocks the deeper work of liberation. Think of Maslow's hierarchy of values. How many people who are in poverty, much less hungry, will be able to turn their minds to practice as we know it? He says the Bodhisattva of compassion may also grant someone's wish as a means of cultivating that being's affinity with the practice of awakening. To be granted one's wish provides the experience of generosity, which can be contagious, encouraging caring for others and the loss of self-centered concerns. This manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, granting beings their desires with his magical jewel, also conveys a sense of kindness and relief with his relaxed, though dignified, bearing. I think based on this, the Kanon print that we have on display right near the water table here at Chapin Mill is one of these turning the wish-fulfilling gem, sitting in the posture of royal ease. It's hard. What you learn, one of the things you learn from this book is that there's all kinds of mixed up variations in all these things. And so it's quite educational to realize how hard it is to be really definitive about any particular canon, and they all, and also based on the different traditions, Buddhist traditions, Zen and Pure Land and Tibetan, they have different meanings. And the Mahayana Sutras frequently encourage their listeners to perform worthy and wholesome practices because of the great merit and benefits to be accrued. The sixth form of Avalokiteshvara is Kunda Avalokiteshvara, Kunda in Sanskrit. This translates as roughly as carry or handle appropriately. And this bodhisattva, this Avalokiteshvara, is primarily known as the mother of Buddhas, and so it has this connection with the Prajnaparamita. It points to the maternal aspect of Avalokiteshvara and may be the source of the Chinese feminization of Avalokiteshvara as Guanyin. In India, Avalokiteshvara was a man, but in China and Japan, she's usually shown as female, almost always. And then the last one is kind of cool. It's the unfailing rope or lasso of Avalokiteshvara. His face is sometimes painted red, and he usually has six or eight arms, one hand holding a rope or noose, others holding other implements that may include a lotus, a monk's staff, and a rosary. This aspect of Avalokiteshvara embodies the unfailing power of the bodhisattva, capable of liberating even the most difficult, incorrigible creatures steeped in resistance to wholesomeness. Using his rope as an implement, this kanon captures and tethers beings until he can bring them to the other shore of liberation. I'm suddenly remembering a scene from a samurai movie where this bumptious, swaggering, loudmouth samurai goes to a Zen temple, and this kindly priest manages to truss him up and hang him up from a branch in a tree. And he hollers and hollers and hollers for days and days, and the priest comes out and smiles benignly, and finally, after a while, he starts settling down, and then when the priest finally lets him down, he's a changed man. We could see this as a metaphor for our own. The need to rein in our thoughts, our unruly thoughts, as a step toward opening our hearts and compassion. I think the basic one of the Kanon figures we have at the center has multiple arms and multiple heads, faces, showing again both eyes and hands and arms. So now back to the koan. These brother monks, one asking the other, Ungan asking Dogo, what use does the Bodhisattva make of all those hands and eyes? Well, we've already gotten a sense of what those signify. They go to the name, regarder. Regarder is covers both seeing and hearing. That's the nice. It's sort of a stiff word, but it covers both of those senses, seeing and hearing. So regarding, noticing the cries, becoming aware of the cries of the world of suffering beings. And then, of course, the hands and the arms would be the response. But Dogo, in his own response, takes a very simple, down-to-earth metaphor that we can all relate to. He says, it is like someone reaching back and groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night. Marvelous, marvelous, rich image for the work of the Bodhisattva, and the Bodhisattva that each of us is in our true nature. Before we can help others, and really this is much of what the spiritual path is about, is at least in the Mahayana tradition, where we take the Bodhisattva vows, it's about how to help others. Many of us aren't that concerned about that when we begin practice. We're just trying to help ourselves. We're trying to find relief from our misery, our self-consciousness, our confusion, our egoism, our unhappiness. And fair enough, okay. If it brings you to practice, it doesn't matter what the motivation is. But if we stay with this long enough, we come to see that there, we cannot never really find peace of mind ourselves without, so long as there are others who are suffering. That will always taint whatever wonderful calm and energy and clarity we earn through our practice. No matter how, what superb condition we can develop ourselves into through practice, then there's still all of those others who are suffering. How do we help them? Well, the first step is to hear their cries, see their suffering. That requires noticing. And to notice the pain of others, we can't be enveloped in our own thoughts. To hear the cries of others, we can't be lost in the static, the background noise of our own thoughts. It's our thoughts that block our seeing, our hearing, and our otherwise noticing, feeling the suffering of others. It has to start with that, with emptying the mind, opening the eyes, opening the ears, becoming attuned to others who are suffering. That's why we can very strongly say that compassion begins with meditation. All right, some of the most compassionate people in this world are people who have suffered themselves the most. They know what it is like, and that having suffered has sensitized them to others' suffering, and that itself makes them want to reach out and help others. But many of us who practice Zen, I would venture to say, would not be those who have suffered the most in the world in the ordinary sense of outward suffering through poverty and hunger and war, terrible ethnic conflict and other things. Most of us who are hearing this now have been spared that because of our good karma. But what we can do is become more sensitive to the suffering that goes on all the time as part of being human. By looking into the mind, absorbing ourselves in the koan, in the breath, we come to see the numberless little ways that we create suffering for ourselves and for others. We don't have to have been through war or abject poverty or starvation to develop our ability to empathize with suffering in general. And in emptying the mind of our thoughts, which are mostly about the self, the I, the my practice, my family, my this, my that, by finding some space in the mind, some stillness, we create a field that is of responsiveness. Starts with the ability to listen better. There's the hearing again, hearing the cries of the world. When we are, our mind isn't a storm of our own opinions and views, then we're able to simply hear what others are saying. In the practice of subsequent koans, koan after one's first koan, we develop this further and further by coming to more effectively see through the words, see what's behind what is being said. This anyone who works with people, a therapist or others, know that what the person is saying is not often not the real underlying problem, the real pain. It's something under that. We find, if we stick with this practice long enough, that we don't have to make a project out of being compassionate. This is what is so... this is the genius of just sitting, is in doing that, but really doing it, in really emptying the mind. Then out of that comes the impulse, the natural impulse, to run or respond. In fact, as so long as we are dwelling in thoughts about me helping others, as long as we're caught in that dichotomy, arguably we can't be help in the deepest way. It's when there's just this simple response. Roshi Kaplow always used to say, in the matters of our fundamental responsibility, in Zen practice, it's simple. It's to respond. And response can be silence. So long as we have the thought of needing to be responsible, or needing to even to respond, then we're not, our heart of compassion is not flowing the way it could be. The response is not flowing. Talk about archetypes of compassion in Sesshin, that is foremostly the monitors. The monitors know that their work for this week, the week of Sesshin, is just that, noticing, responding. The noticing is can be difficult because monitors, having sat for years themselves, want nothing more than to deepen their practice, turn inward, and go to the bottom of the mind, as if there were a bottom. But instead, they have to look, hear, notice, sense. Why? To help, to respond. What you often read in the books about the meaning of a bodhisattva, the definition of a bodhisattva, is one who defers her own ultimate enlightenment in order to help others. But again, to see into our own suffering and the ways we avoid, the ways we reflexively try to avoid our own suffering, the usually minute, often subtle ways, attunes us to the pain of others. And once we can do that, once we can become sensitive to the universality of suffering, the pervasiveness of suffering, then from that we can forgive. There's a Scottish philosopher who died in 1939, a Reverend John Watson, he used the pen name Ian McLaren, who said, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." Mean people are suffering. After Sesshin, with the mind relatively empty, open, responsive, we go back to applying this. We no longer have the luxury of sitting day and night on the mat. Now we're mixing with people, suffering people, people at work, people in our own home, family. Can we listen? Can we notice? Can we hear? It's especially easy for the first few days after Sesshin. Then the clarity, the openness of the mind turns back some. But to go on sitting every day keeps it from shutting down. It also, daily sitting, by creating this space, it enables us to at least have a chance of slowing down a bit. Because when we pass the opportunity when we pass up the opportunity to help people, because we're rushing too much, who doesn't know this experience? You run into someone, you see someone across a parking lot, you see someone doing this, doing that, someone who could use help. And if we falter in our response, sometimes it's just because we have told ourselves, we just can't take the time, we have to hurry on to the next thing. We see this too in our sitting. We see how much of our busyness is self-created, and how much of it really, we could even say, is to avoid our own suffering. Keep yourself busy enough, busy enough, busy enough. Then you don't have to look at the pain underneath that. So Dogo says, it is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow. With outstretched hand in the middle of the night. Beyond a conscious agenda of helping. Automatic response. Out of the darkness. The darkness of no mind. Out of that, we respond no-mindedly. Ungan said, "I understand." Dogo said, "How?" Ungan said, "The whole body is hands and eyes." Yes. We read there that in some of these statues, there's an eye in each hand. And Dogo, you've had your say, but you've only said 80% of it. Ungan, how would you put it? Dogo, the outside is hands, the inside is eye. Well, look at the difference there. Ungan says, the whole body is hands and eyes. Dogo said, the outside is hands, the inside is eyes. Before you draw any conclusions from the fine difference of wording between those two, consider that in the original Chinese, a according to Robert Goldman Sensei, who reads Chinese, speaks Chinese, in the original Chinese copy that he has, Dogo's statement has nothing about inside or outside, but reads, "The entire body is hands and eyes." So look at these two. The first is Ungan, the whole body is hands and eyes, and Dogo in the original Chinese, the entire body is hands and eyes. What's the difference between the whole body and the entire body? That's one of the points of this koan. And there are other translations. The Baba, throughout the body is hands and eyes. The whole is hands and eyes. All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.